Lumen Gentium, the Constitution on the Church of the Second Vatican Council, defined the laity in this way: the faithful who by baptism are incorporated into Christ and integrated into the people of God, made sharers in their particular way in the priestly, prophetic, and kingly office of Christ, having their own part to play in the mission of the whole Christian people in the Church and in the world. One of the parts the laity can play, one of the most sublime parts that the laity can play today or could ever have played, would be that of martyrdom. And martyrdom has been defined beautifully by the Catechism of the Catholic Church in this way: the supreme witness given to the truths of the faith. The martyr bears witness to Christ who died and rose, to whom he is united by charity. He endures death through an act of fortitude. So there we have a definition of the laity and a definition of martyrdom. Both of those definitions could be considered rather contemporary because they come to us in recent years, although what they are expressing about the laity and what they are expressing about martyrdom are timeless truths. In this series, in this program, Defenders of Faith, we are going to talk about a layman who was a great defender of faith, not by the shedding of his blood, but rather by the dry martyrdom that he endured. He was anything but contemporary to us. In fact, he lived during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I in England. And his name is Saint Philip Howard. Philip Howard was born on the feast of two of the greatest martyrs the Church has ever produced, Peter and Paul, on the 29th of June, 1557, and he was christened in the Royal Chapel of Whitehall by Nicholas Heath, the Chancellor of England and the last Catholic Archbishop of York. Philip's father was Thomas Howard, the 4th Duke of Norfolk, and the only Duke in Tudor England. His mother, Mary FitzAlan, was the daughter of the Earl of Arundel. The child, young Philip Howard, was named for King Philip II of Spain, who actually stood in as godfather at the baptism. Queen Mary Tudor was present and many of the members of her court. So you can see we're talking about people who are very, very highly placed in England. Within about a year of this young child's baptism, Queen Mary Tudor died. Her half-sister Elizabeth, of course, would become the Queen of England. Queen Mary died while attending Mass in her bedchamber. 24 hours later, Reginald Pole, the last Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury, died. Some weeks following that, there were a number of other bishops who died in England as the result of a plague. People thought they were just dying off as the result of a plague, and they were, but what people did not realize was the force and the power of Catholicism was very, very quickly ending as we were coming into Elizabethan England. Young Philip's mother never rallied physically from his birth, and she died less than 2 months later. Had she lived, young Philip Howard very likely would have been raised a Roman Catholic, or at least he would have been raised with a very strong Catholic influence. Sometime later, his father, the Duke, remarried. His second wife was Margaret Audley. Margaret Audley had two sons and one daughter. Now, when his second wife died, the Duke married for the third time a woman by the name of Elizabeth Dacre. Elizabeth Dacre was a widow who brought one son and three daughters with her, and they all came to live with the Howard children. Well, by these various marriages that the Duke of Norfolk had, and also by the tremendous acquisition of property that he got as a result of these marriages, Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, had to be considered one of the wealthiest men in England, and he wanted to keep all of his possessions for himself. He wanted to keep all of his property intact, if you will. So he came up with this idea. He decided that all of his children, the Howard children, should marry the Dacre children. That would be the children of his third wife, Elizabeth. By his own marriages, he had three sons and one daughter. The Dacres were three daughters and one son. So you see, these arranged marriages, at least in the mind of Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, worked out rather nicely indeed. Young Philip then, by the time he reached 12 years of age, by agreement with his father, and at least as we are told in his biographies, by his own free consent, was betrothed to Anne Dacre, who would be one of Elizabeth Dacre's daughters. In 1564, his father, the Duke, purchased the London Charter House, where the London Carthusians had lived, and it was in that house in London that the children were raised. Well, at the accession of Queen Elizabeth I to the throne in England, Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, Philip's father, very happily acquiesced and became a Protestant. He had no problem with Protestantism at all. In fact, he probably was attracted a bit more to the Protestant faith, and so he easily conformed to the established church when England changed its allegiances. And when his wife, Elizabeth Dacre, was dying, Thomas Howard even went so far as to refuse her the ministration of a Catholic priest. Well, after his third wife died, Elizabeth Dacre, her mother, a woman by the name of Lady Mounteagle, came to care for the Howard children and the Dacre children and so forth. She was a very devout Catholic, and she was very much of the mind that these children were going to be raised in the old religion. Now, Anne Dacre, who was betrothed to Philip Howard, came very much under the influence of her maternal grandmother. She was very taken by her, and she was very attracted to Catholicism, even as a young girl. The grandmother finally died, and the Duke of Norfolk's Protestant chaplain took young Anne Dacre one day and tried to convince her of the truths of Protestantism, but absolutely to no avail. This girl was continually being attracted to Catholicism. Now, she would be the girl who would marry Philip Howard, and this was going to be a tremendous influence in his life. And then there was a second Catholic influence that came into the life of young Philip Howard as well. The Duke wanted to have his children privately tutored, and he wanted the best education possible for them. So the tutor who was brought into the home to educate young Philip Howard and some of his brothers and sisters who were growing up was a tutor by the name of Gregory Martin. Gregory Martin came to the Howard household from St. John's College, Oxford, where he was a professor. A brilliant, brilliant young man, totally Catholic in his outlook, totally Catholic in his sympathies, and from what we understand, totally unwilling to conform to the established church. Gregory Martin, the private tutor in the home, therefore, exercised a very strong influence on young Philip Howard. Well, when Philip was 14 years of age, this rather carefree life that he was living in London came to a very abrupt end. His father, the Duke of Norfolk, was accused of being in on a plot to murder the Queen. Actually, from what most historians will tell you now, nothing could have been further from the truth. He certainly would not have wanted to murder the Queen from religious reasons because he was a very convinced, happy Protestant. But nonetheless, he was tried and he was convicted of this charge. But before he was executed, in June of 1572, while he was in prison, the Duke of Norfolk, Thomas Howard, wrote this letter to his son, young Philip. "Serve and fear God above all things. Love and make much of your wife. I wish you for the present to make your abode at Cambridge, which is the fittest place for you to promote your learning in. Beware of the court. Beware of the court. When I am gone, forget and forgive my false accusers, but have nothing to do with them if they live." Well, after his father was gone, after his father was executed, Lord Berkeley, who was one of the chief counselors to Queen Elizabeth I, became, if you will, the children's guardian. Lord Berkeley was a staunch and very, very devout Protestant. And because he was the children's guardian, he very quickly dismissed Gregory Martin as their tutor, and he did indeed send young Philip Howard to Cambridge, where his father wanted him to go in the first place. Now, when Philip Howard went to Cambridge as an undergraduate, he was a very fine student, but he became very, very enamored with life at court. Lord Berkeley had taken him around and introduced him to many of the principal figures at the Elizabethan court, and he was totally taken up with and he really was overwhelmed, I think we can say, by life at court. So he began to vie with others of those days, other young courtiers and so forth, to try to win the special favor of the Queen, Elizabeth I. Now remember, it was the same Queen who signed his father's death warrant just so much earlier. Philip really did everything that his father advised him not to do. He became very solidly established in the royal favor, and he often took part in plays for the diversion and the amusement of Queen Elizabeth. Meanwhile, his young wife Anne was at home. She was being neglected, and she was particularly saddened when news came back to her that Philip seemed to be questioning the validity of their marriage. Well, when Philip heard how saddened his young wife Anne was, he wrote to her and he said, "There is none in the world I have offended so much as yourself." Jesuit Father Philip Caraman, a contemporary biographer of St. Philip Howard, puts it this way. While the exact degree of his dissipation is difficult to know, there can be little doubt. According to his first biographer, he patronized young didge abound. In other words, he was a rather immoral living young man himself and unfaithful to his wife. Well, in 1580, Philip officially became the 13th Earl of Arundel following the death of his maternal grandfather. He was the premier Earl of England, and as such, he began to take a very active interest in the affairs of state. He also began to draw closer to his wife, Anne, and she was giving more and more thought herself now to religion. She had always been convinced of the truths of Catholicism, but she had outwardly conformed to the Church of England, although she managed to never, ever take the Anglican form of communion. Well, at this particular period in her life, she read a book on the errors of schism, and she became so convinced by what schism was and how wrong it was that she sought out a Catholic priest, and the Catholic priest reconciled her to the original faith that she had. Now, she knew what she was doing might be very detrimental to her marriage. She knew that she might antagonize her husband, Philip Howard, by becoming a Catholic. And yet Philip did not say a thing about it, and he offered no resistance whatsoever. The reason he did not was because he once heard Edmund Campion arguing with a heretic, and he was so impressed with Edmund Campion that Philip Howard was himself coming around ever so slowly and ever so surely to the truths of the faith. It's somewhat unclear how Philip Howard, or the stages by how Philip Howard approached the Catholic faith, but one historian who has written a very fine history of Arundel Castle, where Philip Howard made his home for many years of his life, the historian who wrote the book on Arundel Castle says this: "Philip is supposed to finally have made up his mind on the religious question while pacing up and down in his grandfather's long gallery in the east wing of the castle." Well, Philip would never regret his decision to indeed return to the faith in which he had been baptized and to become a Roman Catholic. He was received into the church by Jesuit Father William Weston, who was said to be the only Jesuit at the time who was still at liberty in England. He had made his decision after at least 2 years of soul-searching, and that process of soul-searching did not go unnoticed by Queen Elizabeth I. The Queen knew that Anne Howard had returned to Catholicism. The Queen was very jealous of the fact that Philip Howard was spending so much time with his wife and not spending time at court. The Queen was getting very, very upset. After his reconciliation, we are told by one biographer that Philip Howard lived in such a manner as he seemed to be changed into another man, having great care and vigilance over all his actions and addicting himself to piety and devotions. In London, he kept a priest at the Charterhouse, where his presence could more easily be concealed, by whom he could frequently receive the holy sacraments and daily have the comfort to be present at the holy sacrifice of the Mass, whereto with great humility and reverence he himself in person would many times serve." Now, another, besides becoming a Catholic and besides becoming very devout about it, he wanted to see what he could do to help the Catholic cause in England, how he could be the source to build up the Catholic cause. So he writes a letter to Cardinal William Allen at the English College in Douay in the Spanish Netherlands in Belgium. Cardinal Allen was the leader of the Catholic population in exile in Belgium, and he was a very, very highly regarded man, and he writes this letter to the cardinal asking what he can do to help the cause in England. Now, Philip Howard's letter was apprehended, And the response that he received back, that he thought at the time was from Cardinal William Allen, was absolutely nothing but a fictitious letter. The letter was delivered to Arundel Castle by a man by the name of Edward Greatley. Edward Greatley was a priest, a former priest who had apostatized and gone over to the established church. So he comes and he delivers this response, which everyone thought was from Cardinal William Allen, but as we say, it was just a fake. And not only did he deliver the response, but this Edward Greatley began to ingratiate himself at Arundel Castle with the Howard family. In the letter, Cardinal Allen was supposed to have said that Philip Howard should take all means to try to get out of the country while the getting was good, so that he might be able to come to the continent and presumably to meet with Cardinal Allen, and they might discuss the Catholic situation in England. Now, Philip Howard was concerned, he believed he was following the instructions of Cardinal William Allen. And this Edward Greatley said that he would help him to escape. What Edward Greatley was doing was helping Philip Howard to be caught. So, on a given night, Philip Howard was scheduled to set sail from a particular port. His departure was delayed and delayed because of so-called adverse winds and bad weather and all the rest. Well, in point of fact, the winds were not that terribly bad that evening. The weather was not all that intense that evening. They were stalling. Finally, Philip was permitted. He boarded his ship at Lymington, which was a port in Hampshire. And no sooner had the ship left the port, then the ship's master took a lantern, a lit lantern, and he put the lantern out on the side of the ship. Now, that lit lantern hanging out on the side of the ship was a signal for four or five fellows who were in a boat nearby to come and to board the ship. One of the gentlemen who boarded the ship came up to Philip Howard and said that he was under instruction from the Privy Council placing Philip Howard under arrest. You see, it was all a trap. He never got an answer from Cardinal William Allen. He got only a fictitious letter. Philip Howard was brought before the Star Chamber, and he was charged with three offenses: reconciliation with the Catholic Church, attempted flight from the kingdom without the Queen's permission, and corresponding with Cardinal William Allen. He was fined £10,000, and he was committed to prison at the Queen's pleasure. And he was treated with very, very scant courtesy, we might add, by the Lieutenant of the Tower of London. For the first 2 years of his stay in the Tower, he was in solitary confinement. Although occasionally he was able to get out and take walks in an outside area that is called the Queen's Garden. Probably the Queen was trying to soften him up a little bit in the fond hope that he might indeed break down and come back to Anglicanism. But she certainly, certainly misjudged Philip's strength of resolution. What did he do while he was in the Tower of London? He daily set hours of prayer, 2 hours of prayer every morning, an hour and a half prayer in the afternoon, and a quarter hour of prayer in the evening before going to bed, which he particularly gave over to an examination of his conscience for that particular day. In all, Philip Howard was to spend 11 years in the Tower of London. His greatest trial was separation from his wife, Anne, and from their two children. Anne had had another child while he was in the Tower. It was a son. And when his son was born, news never even reached him, and in point of fact, news was kept from him of his son's birth for quite a while. Philip was not, however, without spiritual guidance. Jesuit Father Robert Southwell became a very close friend of Philip Howard's by correspondence, and Southwell would continually write letters to Philip Howard, which he eventually had published, and it became quite a classic of spiritual literature on the advice of some Catholic friends. They were never to meet personally, but the advice and the spiritual admonition and so forth of Jesuit Father Robert Southwell was a constant source of great inspiration to Philip Howard in all the years he was in prison. Very ironically, Robert Southwell would die, he would be executed, he would be one of the martyrs of England, and Philip Howard would live to see his famous spiritual correspondent die and die under very brutal circumstances. Well, once again, as the years went on, Queen Elizabeth I decided to relax a little bit some of the confinement and so forth that Philip had been subjected to. And so he and a number of other prisoners were allowed to go back and forth into each other's rooms. Well, now, the warden of the Tower of London had a very, very fine daughter who was quietly sympathetic to the Catholic cause. And this young lady smuggled investments and hosts and wine and all the accoutrements needed for the offering of Holy Mass. And believe it or not, they were able to oftentimes offer Holy Mass, all of the Catholics together, because there would always be a few priests in the tower at one time. They offered Holy Mass together, and indeed they were able to sustain each other. They were able to sustain each other by their faith. England was always very apprehensive about an attack by the Spanish Armada. And one particular occasion, the prisoners in the Tower of London got wind of the fact that the Spanish Armada was, in point of fact, making its way to England. And they were offering prayers at Mass one day for the welfare of all the Catholics on the Armada, that if they were killed, they would at least be prepared to die and to face Almighty God. Well, that was taken to be a prayer for the basic success of the attempts of the Spanish Armada, and for that particular charge, Philip Howard was actually brought to trial in what has always been considered very much a judicial farce. He went through the mockery of a trial, and before he was convicted, he was asked if he had any requests. He said, "Yes, I do. My requests are that all my debts be paid, that I be allowed to see my son, and that my wife come to visit me." And of course, none of those were honored. Philip Howard was kept in constant suspense about when he might possibly die. Not a bell that sounded that it might not be his knell. Not a footstep was heard that it might not be the messenger of death. Each morning as he rose, he knew not but that before night he might be a headless corpse. Every night as he lay his head upon his pillow, he was uncertain whether the morning might summon him to another world. Well, by about 1593, it became evident that Philip Howard was not going to shed his blood, but that he would indeed die the death of, as we would call him, a dry martyr. He did have a number of relatives who were still in influential places in government, and because of that, they kept interceding for postponement and postponement and postponement, and finally, he did indeed die very peacefully in his bed, and he died in a very emaciated kind of a state, but nonetheless, he did die a natural death. Politely, but with great sorrow, Philip told the lieutenant of the Tower of London he could not accept the offer of the Queen to reconcile to Anglicanism and to be allowed to leave the Tower. Some people thought that he had foreknowledge of the day of his death. Maybe he did. He used to write his prayers out in a spiritual diary, a spiritual journal every day. And at one particular point, he just stopped writing. He seemed to know that perhaps on that day, he was going to die. The day he stopped writing, October 19th, 1595, the actual day of his death. His body was taken to the Tower Chapel for a little bit of a funeral service, and this is what the clergyman said: "We are not come to honor this man's religion. We publicly profess and here openly protest otherwise. To be saved, we do not know. We're not honoring his offense. The law has judged him. We leave him to the Lord. He hath gone to his place." Philip Howard's son was going to conform briefly to the Anglican faith, but he came back. His grandson would actually die for the faith many years later during the Titus Oates plot in British history, and the grandson of Philip Howard was the last martyr of the English Reformation. In 1874, Philip Howard was declared blessed, and in October of 1970, Edmund Campion, Robert Southwell, and Philip Howard were canonized along with 37 others as saints of the Roman Catholic Church. A man who died the death of a dry martyr, what a magnificent defender of faith Philip Howard was.